All right, we got a big one. This is gonna be. You know what? We've had some fantastic guests on the energy front. Scott, let's introduce Lee. Let's bring him on.
We got a commodity heavyweight today, guys. You picked a good day to tune into Grizzle Live. So we're gonna bring on Lee Gearing of GNR Associates. He's been in the oil commodities game for a long time. So we're gonna pick his brain on everything commodities. So let's go to Lee. Lee, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you guys. Thank you guys very much for having me.
Yeah, Lee, thank you so much for joining us. And guys, this is a real treat. Lee, do you want to give us your background? Because it's a colorful background. If you guys follow commodities, Lee's a legend. You'd manage some serious assets in your time. Yeah, so billions. You'd managed a fund that was over $5 billion. Maybe you could start from the beginning, Lee. Tell us your history with resources, because it's a long one. And with resources, you need people who've seen the cycles over and over. They just have this sixth sense about it. But tell everyone your history.
Yeah, well, my history goes a long way back, and I love telling the story. Both my parents worked in the oil and gas industry, and both of them worked for Exxon. And they actually met at Exxon's old Bayway refinery, which is just outside of here in New York City on the New Jersey Turnpike, which gives New Jersey Turnpike so much charm. They actually met in that refinery in World War II. And growing up, I distinctly remember, my parents talking about the oil and gas industry, especially my father. And he used to, this is a true story, this is the mid-1960s. My father used to lecture my brother and me on global warming. He would say, sons, we're burning a lot of hydrocarbons, we're putting a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere, and someday this may wind up being a problem regarding the climate. So the thing is that oil and gas was a tabletop conversation, and resources in general were tabletop conversations from the time I was a little kid. And so I always wanted to get into the resource space, primarily, via Wall Street, because I was very interested in the stock market growing up. And finally, I became lead portfolio manager of the old Prudential Jennison Natural Resource Funds, which are still in existence today. I took those over in 1991, and I think the Prudential Jennison Fund at the time had like $60 million of assets, and they were thinking of closing it down. And when I left Jennison in 2005, I think it had a couple billion dollars assets, and we had compiled a phenomenal track record. In 2005, I went to work for the Chilton Investment Company, run by Richard Chilton. It was invited to go over and start a brand new natural resource fund in the hedge fund format. I went there with nothing, no assets whatsoever, and in the next 3 years, we grew that fund to be over $5 billion of assets. And I managed that fund for close to 11 years. And in 2015, I decided to retire and go off and do something else. And with my partner, my colleague at Chilton, Adam Rosenzweig, we started Gearing & Rosenzweig Associates on January 1st, 2016. And we are a firm that's dedicated to researching and investing in global commodity markets. And we've been doing that since 2016 exclusively.
Incredible. You're an Exxon love child. Is that right?
Yes.
Allegedly conceived in a refinery, huh?
It's true. My parents met there in World War II.
That is the most beautiful energy story I've ever heard. I didn't know it was going to be a tearjerker, Lee. I didn't know that. Why did you tell me that? That's incredible. So you have energy in your blood. It runs through you.
Yeah, and I do. And it's funny. I remember before my father worked for Exxon in World War II, he worked out in the El Segundo refinery of Chevron. And my father was an aviation fuel specialist. And of course, if you read Daniel Yergin's The Prize, he talks about that what he believes that one of the reasons why the United States was able to win World War II is because the U.S. was able to crack the code on being able to refine 100 octane aviation fuel in quantity, which neither the Japanese or the Germans could do. And that enabled the U.S. planes to fly faster. It was simple as that. And he was an aviation fuel specialist. He did that all the way through the war. First in Chevron, and then Exxon. And it's interesting. He used to tell his boss in Chevron, whom I know it's interesting, I think he didn't get along with, but that his boss eventually went to head Chevron's exploration teams that discovered the great Saudi oil fields in the late 1940s. So, I mean, like I said, oil and gas talk was tabletop discussion growing up.
Incredible. So Lee, you know, where we stand today, obviously, you know, having someone with your number of years, your experience, having seen so many cycles, where we stand today in terms of the energy alarm bell, how would you categorize the current situation? How dire is it? When I see prices going up 10% per day in the commodities that we use to just heat homes, it's not a good thing.
And that is, people are now beginning to recognize that we're slipping into a global energy crisis. It first manifests itself in global natural gas markets, and you know, particularly in Europe, but it's going to spread over into just about every energy market that we have going forward, including within the next year. We'll talk about this. It's going to spill over to global oil markets because there's a number of very interesting factors at work. So, you know, this energy crisis has taken everyone by surprise, and I should point out, except us. Back in the summer of 2020, when, you know, we were about 2 months or 3 months after oil prices hit minus -$37 a barrel, we titled our second quarter 2020 natural resource commentary letter, we titled it "The Coming Energy Are on the Verge of an Energy Crisis." And so what's happening now is that, you know, we in all our investments, we as I mentioned before, I did not, but we love to get involved in the bottom of bear markets. And you know, we lay out a roadmap that we're going to travel down to make sure we're going in the right direction, and we check the mileposts as we go down that. So we laid out that roadmap back in the summer of 2020, and we're just following it perfectly right now. So, there's two big factors that everyone has missed, and why those factors have now produced this energy crisis. And one of them is very interesting. One of them has to do with global energy demand.
Like, right.
And one of the things that most people that follow most commodity markets and certainly energy markets is they focus a lot on supply, and it's easier. You know, we know what the project's going to be. We can have a good idea when they're coming on. We talk to companies and then tell you what their growth profiles are going to be. However, looking forward in the world of demand is much more difficult because it's one of these abstract concepts. What is going to be demand in several years? And one of the funny things that's gripped all energy markets over the last decade is this idea that we're going to be reaching this point of peak demand, not peak supply, but peak demand. Where
total electric vehicles and the like and all of that, the future, and this idea that hydrocarbons can be turned into what wood was once, you know, this idea you just retire these old things and we move on to newer and better.
That's exactly right. And so everyone believes that, you know, here we are sitting at a, you know, peaked at 2019 global oil demand at about a little over 99 million barrels a day. And you know, by 2030, it will be 93 million barrels a day. And we disagree with that tremendously. And it's based upon a lot of the really original research we've done. And here's the research and why it's so important. One of the interesting things about all emerging market economies is that they all go through their growth cycles and enter a phase in that growth cycle where the energy intensity usage in that economy begins to grow much more rapidly than the economy does. Mm-hmm. And there are a variety of reasons in it. For example, I mean, with oil, it's very simple. You know, when you're a poor country, you have per capita GDP of $2,000 or less, you all ride around on bicycles and motorcycles. However, as you get richer and richer, what do? You ditch the bicycle, you get a moped, then you get a motorcycle. Then eventually you get really, you get more richer, you get a Toyota. And then when you, you know, finally get out of the middle income into the lower strungs of high income, you go out and buy a BMW and Mercedes. And every one of those, that traveling up the transportation chain takes more and more energy. And so what's so interesting about that, you know, it, that we're talking about a phase in an economy where you're going between $2,000 per capita GDP at the low end up to about $20,000 per capita GDP in the high end. And what's so interesting is that notch, 2000 to 20,000, between the late 1940s all the way to 2000, there were about 1 to 1.5 billion people in that notch phase during that entire time period. However, starting in 1920, there was a seismic shift that took place in the number of people living in that high intensity energy period. It basically has gone from 1.5 billion. Today, it sits at almost 4 billion. And you know, obviously, the two big players that entered that that period was China back in the early 2000s, and now India is entering that period as well. And you're also, think of all the other countries that are in that period as well: the Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, potentially Myanmar, and Pakistan, Bangladesh. And we're talking about another 2 billion people right there. So the thing is that you have this big bulge of people that are going through their period of high energy intensity consumption, and that's a factor that no one has paid any attention to over the last decade. And it's interesting that this impact of what I'm talking about shows up in all the numbers. For example, the IEA, the International Energy Agency, since 2010, every year, they have underestimated global oil demand from their original projections to their final steady state projection. They underestimated by about 1 million barrels a year. And that underestimation continues today. For example, for 2020, they estimate that the global oil demand was 22 million barrels a day. We would say it's much, much closer to 95 million barrels a day. And that underestimation of demand continues. And that's one of the reasons why we have slipped into this energy crisis, because we think oil energy consumption is going down and it's doing just the opposite. In fact, it looks like it's actually surging right now.
So Lee, can I ask a question? So I guess the oil demand bears would say that, EV is now starting to supplant that historical relationship. How would you push back on that?
It's going to be, we have done a huge amount of work on EVs, and we've done a huge amount of work on all renewables, in the sense that none of them make sense on their what we call their energetics. That is the amount of energy you have to put in to make these things, to fuel them, and to run them. Right. It just doesn't make any sense, and it shows up in the numbers. And we'll talk about this, because this is the roadmap that the EV, if it's going to go down, it's going to go down. That you take something like the Nissan Leaf, it's basically a $40,000 car. It gets, until you upgrade the battery, it gets, I think, maybe 160 miles a charge, things like that. And compare that to the Nissan Sentra, which is basically the same size car. That car costs you $20,000, half the amount, and you can get about 350 miles per filling of the tank, mileage per tank fill. And so the thing is, are you going to buy the Leaf, or with all the annoyances of fiddling with this battery to make sure it's recharged, or are you going to buy the Sentra? Where are you going to buy the Sentra? However, one of the things that's going to happen, they're going to try to do, and it's in this new $3.5 billion transportation bill, we're going to try to subsidize the EV purchases.
Yeah.
Because think of the EV this way. It's so simple. Never before, every energy transition that we've ever made, and the use of that energy, is because we consume that energy more efficiently. And so the thing is that that's why, you know, that we've progressed down the road of the internal combustion engine versus the electric battery. It's just a much more efficient way to do it. And the thing is that never before in the history of mankind have we been able to displace an old technology with a new technology that has inferior energetics.
Yeah. And that concept, Lee, is energy return on energy invested, right?
Exactly. That's what it is.
And that is something that you know, the new green avant-garde doesn't want to teach, right? Because, you know, that spoils the story a little bit, right?
Yeah. And here's a classic real life example of that energy return on investment, energy in, energy out argument. And you look at jet travel. Obviously, one of the great technological advances in jet travel took place in the late 1960s with the British and French invention of the Concorde. And the Concorde, you know, you look at all the YouTube videos on it. It was a technological marvel. It really was. Cut flying time in half, things like that. However, the whole energy return on energy investment in the plane is terrible. And so, you know, you fly at the competing technology at the time was the Boeing 747. You fly one passenger from New York to London. It takes you X amount of fuel to do so. To fly that same passenger on the Concorde took 3X the time of, amount of fuel. And so, yes, you know, it was a technological marvel, but the energy return versus energy used investment was so poor that it could never displace the old technology. And it didn't until the Concorde literally went away. And, you know, the Concorde, when it was all said and done, had become the playthings of Hollywood celebrities, rock stars, and investment bankers. Doesn't that sound like the buyer of the Tesla today?
Yeah.
It's true.
Damn right.
Can I ask about, there's another piece of the puzzle with EVs, which is infrastructure. I was wondering if you had a view on, you know, these charging stations seem like they're important if you actually want to use your EVs and go on the trips that you would make a few times a year. And I'm wondering if you think, does infrastructure, is that a key part for EV adoption? Like, does that kind of have to go first, or can it kind of follow past people buying the cars?
It probably does have to go first, but there's a flaw that no one wants to talk about in this whole recharging of lithium batteries, is that a lithium battery, in order to maintain its long-term vibrancy, its viability, has to be charged slow. And if you charge it fast, you damage the physical properties within the batteries itself. So the thing is that you know, if you plan to drive from New York to Florida with an EV, you're going to have to fast charge it. And that's going to wind up damaging your battery. And I know a friend of mine drove from New Jersey to Florida. He mapped it all out with charging stations along the way. They were rapid chargers. And he swore when he came back that his Tesla battery had been degraded. And so, you know, that's going to be a problem. And you cannot overcome that. That is a physical limitation that is inherent within the lithium battery itself. So it's going to, that will go a long way, but it's still going to be a problem.
Yeah, the physics of batteries, there's still some issues here that people, it's rarely talk about that. They just talk about the price of the car, but that's very important.
The batteries are hugely, and I'm not the wrong person. I'm not the right person, Gary and Rose is right to talk about this, because Adam is an expert on batteries. He knows all the issues. So I'm going to defer to him. But
we're going to get Adam back on it. And those who are wondering, we have two partners here, Adam and Lee. It's been fantastic to have Lee on. We're looking forward to keeping the dialogue going with you guys. Now, I want to just reach out to everyone watching on Twitter, YouTube, guys. If you guys are liking just the absolute brilliance that Lee's bringing to the Grizzle channel to Twitter, please give that a retweet, give it a like on YouTube, give that a thumbs up. You know what to do. You know what? We're just this is fantastic conversation with a literal legend, a resource investing legend, been at it since 91 with some of the original resource funds up to, and it's incredible history with resources. And you just dropped so much insight on this. I'm just wondering, another fly in the ointment for EV, before we had what I'd call a benign electricity environment, it looks like we could be entering a period where that's not so benign anymore, right? I think that the other input into charging your car, et cetera. I just wonder how that works, and I think more broadly, just your thought on how we get out of this current energy crunch, electricity crunch. Your thoughts on what's happening in Europe in the future.
Okay, let's talk about what's happening in Europe and how that is going to spill over into the rest of the world, and because it's happening because of fundamental reasons. And then we can talk about how, when we realize that how unstable our grids are becoming because of the renewable input and what that eventually does to people thinking about buying EVs and things like that. That's a whole nother metaphysical issue, but we can talk about that. Well, what's going on in Europe right now is that, we're bumping up again against that whole concept of very strong global energy demand. In this case, the demand for natural gas. And again, we've done a huge amount of work on what are the driving factors of global natural gas demand. And we've written about it. In fact, in our, I believe it was our fourth quarter letter of last year, we talked about how global LNG demand was going to soar. And that's the term that we actually titled the article with. But the thing is that we talked about oil and how its intensity rises dramatically above the growth rates during that nuts period. The same thing happens with natural gas for a slightly different reason. When a country is poor, again, you can say $2,000 per capita GDP or less, a country burns coal to generate its electricity. Why does it burn coal? Because coal is cheap. It's a solid fuel. It's easily handleable. It's transportable and it's easily stored. You just put it right out on the ground. However, coal causes a lot of pollution. And when a country gets richer, one of the things that the population desires is it desires a cleaner environment. And it's interesting. I went to a conference, an Alpine macro conference, where somebody talked about what are the 10 issues that are most bothering the general Chinese population in China today. And three of them are environmental. Two of them have to do with air quality. And the funny thing is, so as you get richer, you don't want to look up at a brown sky. It bothers you. You say, it's time for us to stop degrading our environment. Well, one of the ways you do that is you switch over from burning coal to burning natural gas. Now, the problem with natural gas, it's a much more expensive fuel to burn. Why? Because it's a gas and it's not a solid. So it requires a huge amount of additional infrastructure for it to be used. You have to have storage tanks. You have to have pipelines. And if you use natural gas, you have to have reliquification facilities, things like regasification facilities, things like that. So it's gas is a commodity that can only afforded by people who are getting richer and richer. However, that's exactly what we're seeing in huge parts of the developed world. China, all those countries that I mentioned before, now India, they have all either in the middle or in the lower end of that period where natural gas consumption is exploding. And it's not only growing with the economy, but it's also growing because it's taking market share away from coal. And so the thing is that, people that are bearish on global gas, they haven't done this modeling. We wrote about it. We said that even on the most bearish demand assumptions between now and 2030, that the demand for global LNG, which, is a function of demand minus the ability to supply with pipeline, land-based natural gas, is going to be double what's the most optimistic estimates of supply are. And so the thing is that what's happened with Europe is that they had a February and March were colder than normal. Same in Russia, they had a late cold winter. They let their inventories draw down to below normal. And this summer, when they said, okay, let's get serious about refilling those inventories, and a huge amount of their inventory refill has to happen through liquefied natural gas because the decline in natural gas production from the North Sea, that they would have to buy the natural gas and oops, it's not there. Asia is bidding it away. And so you know, that's when you start to see a lot of price pressure. The supply wasn't available. So they entered, they're just about to enter the withdrawal season with below, much below normal inventories. And so now everyone is panicking because if Europe has a colder than normal winter, not only will you have massive price spikes, but you run the risk of actually physically running out. And right. So that's the problem. And it's because of the global strength in gas demand. And that global gas demand is going to be a factor in these markets for the between now and 2030, regardless. And, you know, and not only as opposed to oil, which has a negative ESG influence, there's a positive ESG influence in gas, because if you displace coal with gas, you produce half the amount of CO2 to generate.
You know what, Lee, we talk about that so much, and you know, at Grizzle, we just say, you know, this idea of you know, natural, we think natural gas, assuming that there is this world out there where you know, we are able to displace carbon completely, but in the medium term, transitory, for all the benefits you get environmentally, particulate matter, carbon, the like, there's nothing more superior than natural gas. And the ability to bring it on in scale as quickly as you can, there's nothing close. I want to get your thought on that point, because this is a big discussion right now, is okay, which makes a ton of sense, right? You know, you move up this wealth curve. You don't want to look at, you know, murky, smoggy skies. You move from coal to natural gas. Then, you know, and I'm thinking about baseload, right? So you have, what are my options on baseload? And right now we are having a baseload crisis. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, we've destabilized the grid because we brought on all these variable sources of power. Where, let's talk about baseload. So what are our options here? Natural gas, coal, and nuclear. Just wanted to get your thought on nat gas versus nuclear. Just compare and contrast. Because obviously in the developed world, there's been a hard problem here. NIMBY has been something very sticky here. And personally, you know, Grizzle has a hard time seeing how NIMBY goes away for nuclear and how nat gas isn't just the superior
in the medium term when this energy source is needed. Like, can it actually get built to come in and supply the world?
Yeah, we talk all about that because there's a lot of very interesting issues that you bring up. And the ultimate solution to all our problems is nuclear. And I'm going to bring out a very interesting factoid about nuclear, which most people don't talk about, but it is so, the energy return on energy invested in nuclear is so off the charts that you could, if we were to go over to all nuclear today, we could have a period of a global growth that would be equivalent to what we saw at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution to today. I mean, that's how energy efficient nuclear power is. But the thing is that you're right. First thing we should do is we should be displacing coal with natural gas. Now, the problem with that is that as a $50 gas price in Europe and a $35 gas price in Europe and a $50 gas price in Asia shows you that we're now, we're bumping up against, you know, severe supply restraints relative to demand in global natural gas markets. And that's going to require a lot of investment to make in a whole nother round of LNG facilities, which are tough. I mean, look at Mozambique. That's going to be a big one. However, there's a low-level civil war going on there right now. Right. And so the thing is, are you going to spend $8 billion in an area which is disputed by various tribal groups with Mozambique? There's a long-term supply issue with natural gas relative to demand. Can it be the great swing fuel, which it should be? But I suspect, you know, you're seeing it be rationed by price right now.
Lee, could you see the U.S. come on in a big way? If they were incentivized by price, could they build a lot more LNG export facilities and kind of be that producer of last resort?
This brings up another very interesting issue. You know, obviously, what's happened in the U.S. gas business industry over the last 15, almost 20 years has been nothing less than stupendous. And it's been all because of the shale gas revolution. You know, U.S. gas supply bottomed. I think it, you know, might have been a couple weeks back in 2004, 2005, U.S. gas supply was basically 50 to 52 BCF a day. And by the fourth quarter of 2019, natural gas supply had hit 97 Bs a day. It grew by almost 100%.
Incredible.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And basically, it's because of the shale gas revolution. And if you want to be more specific, it's basically because of really three sources of gas. One was the Marcellus. The Marcellus, which was basically discovered back in 2003 by Range Resources, came on with a vengeance like around 2010. And it went from zero BCF a day to almost 25 Bs a day at its peak. So that was responsible for over half the gas supply increase in America. And then you had the Haynesville that went from zero to 10. And then you had the associated gas from the various shale oil fields, including the Permian. So you had this massive expansion in gas supply. And of course, we went from importing liquefied natural gas in the U.S. in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, that we're now exporting 10 BCF a day of liquefied natural gas.
Lee, now, can I ask a question there? Because you bring up a great, you know, historical points here of just how this expanded. Now, this couldn't have been done without cheap money and cheap debt specifically, right? Maybe your thoughts on that. And obviously, that, you know, it's kind of a, you know, when I think about it, it's a different way to think about it. Obviously, you have this flush of money, free money, effectively cheap borrowing, that ultimately enabled this technological revolution, if you will. I just want to, you know, flesh out, do we see that money come back? I just wanted to kind of interject that point in how you think money played a role in this whole situation.
Money played a huge role in it. And however, there were actually, you know, really two factors at work. One was the introduction of a new technology, and or a couple new technologies that were put together, which caused the shale revolution. And that was obviously horizontal drilling and hydrofracking, which were enabled for oil and gas companies to basically produce both first natural gas and then oil from rock that had so little permeability that it could never flow. We always knew that there was a lot of gas in these shales, and we always knew there was a lot of oil in these shales, but we had no understanding of how to get it out. And we cracked that nut, that technological nut, in the early 2000s. And so you had the introduction of a new technology. You had a lot of resource available. We all knew where these shales were because we've been drilling through them for the last 80 years, and we knew everything about them. We knew that they were very receptive to these new technologies to unlock the oil and gas potential there, and then we had the money, the free money, so we could just borrow an infinite amount of money and just literally drill like crazy for a decade. Now the what's interesting about the shales in the U.S. is that, you know, we do a lot of work on this. You know, in fact, some of our work I think is really, you know, it's the best. And you know, we're a big believer that, you know, back in the early 2000s in the shale plays and the mid 2000s in the oil plays, is that you had a lot of geological resource there. However, that geological resource now in most of the shales has been all drilled up. That is your best prospects have been drilled up. So now what you've got to do is you've got to start drilling your prospects that aren't so good. And so those can be done, but you need much higher prices and a lot more capital. Because like say for example you're drilling a well in the Permian today, an oil well, you're drilling that and it costs you say $7 million to drill and complete, and that well produces 1,000 barrels a day BOE of hydrocarbons when it starts to produce. It's a top tier well. What happens if those are all gone and now you have to do second tier wells where you're still spending $7 million, but instead of getting 1,000 barrels of oil a day, you're only getting 500. And that's what's happening throughout all the shales today. The Permian still got a little bit of top tier acreage left. It's got some, so drilling activity is going to increase there. But all the other shale plays, both oil and gas are now have now passed their best days, and now they're all beginning to suffer from exhaustion and resource depletion. And it's because they drilled out their top-tier inventories. And they drilled it out very, very fast. Why they drilled it out very fast? Because the money was cheap. They could borrow at zero rates, and they just drilled like crazy.
And so Lee, I've got a question for you, because this is just making a ton of sense. And what's the incentive price that we need in, you know, offshore to get natural gas going in America? Like, what is this price that went to bring this global supply demand back into balance? And obviously you mentioned a lot of, there needs to be a ton of CapEx in LNG gasification facilities and the like, but clearly we need price to get to the right point and then a ton of investment behind that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The price is probably a lot higher than we think. And it's because of just what I said. It's geological resource exhaustion, in the sense that like especially in the shales, like I said, they're responsible for 80 to 90% of all non-OPEC and all world oil growth.
Yeah.
Over the last decade, and that they of the three or four great shale oil basins, they've all been exhausted except for the Permian. And so the thing is, does $100 oil, does that really incent people to drill? Probably it does, but it's basically going to be more just to maintain production, maybe grow it a little bit, than actually really you know, have where we're growing our shale oil every year by 1.5 to 1.75 million barrels per year. We're never going to see that again. And so, just to show you that this phenomena at work, you know, we sort of treat the shale plays as being almost an infinite resource, and nothing could be further than the truth. The first two great shale gas plays discovered, the Barnett back in 2002, 2003, and then the Fayetteville in 2005, 2006, both those shale gas plays, and they're great shale plays, they ramped up, peaked, and now are in severe decline. In fact, the Barnett today is, the production from the Barnett is about 60% below its 2012 peak. And the Fayetteville is now about 60% below its peak. And I should point out that neither the Barnett nor the Fayetteville have a gas rig drilling on them today, even at $5 gas. So that's resource exhaustion. Yeah. And that's gonna affect more and more of all the shale plays, including the Marcellus on the gas side, and including, you know, it's affecting the Eagle Ford, the Bakken, the DJ Basin, mm-hmm. And it's going to affect the Permian in the next couple of years.
So Lee, I want to ask you your bullish view on, you know, shale exhaustion. Is that because you think even if prices hit, say, 100 and these guys are generating some free cash flow, do you assume they're not going to put it back into the ground like they usually do? Or is it that even if they do that, because of the geology and the exhaustion, it's not going to be enough?
It's not going to be enough, because think about it again, going back to my example, you're going to, you know, say the, what happens if, for example, I'm drilling all these top tier acreage last year, and I get 1,000 barrels a day. Now I have to shift all my rigs over to tier two acreage, and I only get 500 barrels a day IP rates on those wells. I've got to drill twice as many wells to replace the ones that I were drilling last year. And so you have the rig count goes up, but the funny thing is the production stays flat. Hmm. And that's the phenomenon we're going to see.
Okay.
So, and like, for example, it's very interesting to watch, like on the gas side, the Marcellus, like I said before, has been the biggest single source of gas supply. That's phenomenal. 0 to 25 Bcf a day in 10 years. That's incredible. That even with gas prices at $5 and $6, the drilling activity in the Marcellus has not picked up at all. So the thing is that, you know, obviously the Eastern Marcellus is really suffering from depletion issues. And that's why Cabot Oil and Gas, with the premier acreage position there, put itself up, you know, merged with Cimarex Energy. But the thing is that the fact that the rig count hasn't gone up is sort of, you know, an indicative point that we are, there's not the prospects to drill even at $5 gas.
So are you thinking, I guess, the marginal cost of shale has been increasing significantly since 2012 when people thought it was, you know, $40, then maybe it's then $50 in 2016. That continues to go up as we see this resource depletion.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, the evolution of the shales is the same evolution that takes place in every either natural gas or oil reservoir. You know, you make your initial discoveries, you do a lot of exploratory drilling, you know, you begin in your drilling, you begin to understand what the core, the best pockets, acreage positions are in these deposits, and then you slowly move all your rigs to drill those best tier one prospects. And then what happens is that you leave behind the two tier prospects. So your drilling productivity goes up over time and your costs come down and everything's great. And then one day you wake up and you've exhausted your tier one inventory. And then all of a sudden you say, what do I do? Well, either I abandon the play altogether or I need higher prices to begin to drill this more marginal tier two prospects. And that's what you're seeing in the shales today. So the costs are going to go up hugely. And you're going to, as the costs go up, you need higher prices.
Gosh. Leah, I have a question for you. You know, because at the surface, you know, obviously as a resource investor, this feels like we're starting a massive super cycle, right? And it just feels like, I don't know, to use the baseball analogy, second inning, third inning, is that a fair characterization of where we're at? And then, I guess the corollary to that is when should I get worried in the sense that this is, you know, obviously a prospective time to put capital into the ground or to be invested in resources. But when do we get to like prices so high that it just kills demand? Troubling situation.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Your first question is very interesting, Thomas. What was it?
What inning in the super cycle would you say we are if there is a super cycle coming?
Yeah, I think what it is that we are only beginning this. I think that you know, if you look at the histories of commodity bull markets, and there's been, you know, in the 20th century there were three of them. Ironically, one of them took place in the midst of the Depression, which is hard to believe, but it did. You know, the second was in between 1969 and 1980, and the third was between 2000 and 2011. And each one of those bull markets takes about 10 years. And you go from a radical undervaluation of commodities relative to financial assets to overvaluation. And we've put those charts in our letter, so you know.
That's a great, guys, I'm just gonna highlight that again. That is a great way to look at this. Commodities versus financial assets. So what would be the ratio? Are you talking, is that just the market in general, or is that like, what's that ratio look like for you?
It is, if you notice the last time we ran that chart about 2 years ago or a year ago, and we made an all-time new low. Commodities were, you know, far cheaper than they were back in 1928, 29, far cheaper than they were back in 1970, and far cheaper than they were in 2000, 2001. So we made an all-time low cheapness. And if we were to run that thing today, it's gone up a little bit, but it's almost like a blip. We have so much longer left to run on this cycle. And you know what's interesting about the cycle too, remember, is that the amount of money that's been printed, that what happens if all of a sudden everyone wakes up one day and says, oh, I've got to buy an energy stock, or I've got to buy something. Not only do I want to protect myself from the inflation that this may all cause, but I want to profit by it. Yeah. No one's thinking along those lines yet. Everyone wakes up every day. Everyone, all these dinners I go to and things like that, I sit around a table. There is not one manager at that table that owns an energy name. Here's a good example of how little participation there is in this space, especially the energy space. Copper's become a popular commodity. And, you know, we wrote about the green element of copper 5 years ago, did this huge essay about, you know, renewable investments going to require, you know, a massive increase in copper investment in that. And now people are finally coming around to understand that. So copper has become, you know, did very, very well. It doubled in price. Copper stocks did well. It's green metal. I could invest in that. And we actually saw institutional participation in copper investments. For example, if you look at the copper, look at the copper stock ETF, the COPX, yep. The open interest in that from, you know, over the last year has gone up. It's gone up like two and a half times. Wow. And look at the XOP, which is the S&P Exploration and Production Index ETF. That XOP rose almost as much as the copper stocks, the COPX. And do you know what the open interest in that did? It went up nothing. The entire rally off the bottom of last summer to today, wow, has been short covering. There's been no, wow, institutional investment at all. And so the thing is, how exciting is this? We're talking about all the fundamentals had this massive shift. This thing is going to go on for years, and there's not one institutional investor investing in it. And you know, so the thing is that everyone's going to miss this first leg. They're missing it right now, and they can only come in. And so that has yet to come, and maybe that'll be 2 years from now or 3 years from now. So, but this still has this is going to be, you know, a decade long, rolling bull market that's going to come and go. There's going to be some pullbacks and things like that.
Lee, I forgot the second part of my question because this is—you're enthralling us. We have a comment out here. One of those talks that you hope never ends, and I can certainly affirm that. And Lee, thank you so much for all the insights you're bringing. So the second half of my question. So the first was: where are we in the inning of this bull market? And you clearly laid that out very early. Second is: when do we get worried that obviously the price is going to go up significantly? You know, we're seeing that in natural gas. When do we worry about demand destruction? Dare I say the recession word? All these things that genuinely, pull back resource demand.
It's a hard question, and I think it's going to be a function of what happens to things like that don't exist today, like inflationary psychology, in the sense that, you know, if we get inflationary psychology. People say, well, I'm going to buy oil today because I'm going to buy gasoline today, even if it costs me $6, because I know that next year it's going to cost me $8, or the next time I fill up, it's going to cost me more. So the thing is that I think that commodity prices could go higher than what people think. Demand destruction is going to be the first argument trotted out by the commodity bears, like sure, it is always, as proof that this bull market's over. And I would say that this bull market, because of the underlying fundamentals and those demand fundamentals that I talked about in the beginning part of our podcast are at work, it's going to be very, very difficult to squeeze that demand out of the system. So I think that prices, it's hard to say. Look at the gas. European gas hit $35 in MCF. Asian gas actually spiked to 50. That's almost, you know, at $50, that's the equivalent of $300 oil. Who would have thought that gas that last year was $5 in MCF was going to go to 50, went up tenfold, but it did. And we're only talking about demand destruction taking place there now, which, mind you, that's going to be a factor in the oil crisis. All that switching from natural gas to oil, you still have facilities that can switch to residual fuel oil. They're doing that right now. That's going to add another 500 to 700,000 barrels a day. Global oil.
No one's thinking about that right now.
No one's thinking about that. So the thing is that it's going to be trotted out as an argument that this bear market can't go on. My gut feel is it goes a lot higher. And the reason is because those underlying demand fundamentals in the emerging market world are still strongly at work. And like I said, very few people think about that or understand those factors.
Lee, So we have to talk about, we're talking about European power, European energy. We have to talk about Putin here. He's basically put on a masterclass.
Right? He has. And, you know, it's interesting. Some people disagree with me, but I really do think that he's teaching the Europeans who's boss and you know, how much power he does have. And, you know, he's got a lot of gas. And now I'm not so sure that it come in time to save. We have cold weather in Western Russia and Europe, whether that supplies can do much to change the underlying fundamental supply demand trends in Europe for this winter. However, Russia does have a lot of gas, and you know, they they've got the there's that whole brand new area up at the Yamal Peninsula, and there's a lot of gas there. So, but it's going to require a lot of investment, because when you think about it, you know, Yamal Peninsula, I think you're 300 miles above the Arctic Circle. It's some, you know, obviously the most harsh condition, operating conditions on Earth. And I've said, I've been to the polar gas fields of Gazprom, so I know what's like up there. And it's impressive of how challenging it is. And so the thing is that he's gonna let the Europeans know that I potentially control your fate going forward. I think he's doing that right now. You know, he's saying he's a good guy, but the increase in gas supplies is coming will be slow.
Right.
So is there a relief valve for Europe this winter? Or it seems like, I was looking into it a little bit. It looks like on the U.S. LNG side, North America, there's not a lot of spare capacity to send over this way. Is it kind of, they're going to have to fend for themselves this winter?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that obviously, you know, one of the causes is the fact that wind farms, especially in the UK, have been radically underperforming relative to all their feasibility projections. And of course, that's a topic for another day, because every wind farm has radically underperformed relative to the traditional feasibility projections.
There you go.
But Lee, this is particularly bad from what I've read. Just headlines are like, wind just stopped.
Where's the wind?
Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, maybe that might bail them out. Wind might return to more normal blowing levels, things like that. They're desperately trying, you know, to burn as much coal as they can right now. So they're trying to fire up as many coal plants as they can. If they have the ability to switch these natural gas plants over to residual fuel oil, which many of them still do, they're trying to do that. Like I said, in Europe, that's adding almost 500,000 barrels a day of oil demand to the European demand picture, right, as we speak. So they're trying all these things.
Lee, how perverse is it that basically all of these environmental initiatives has now basically led, the UK to turn back their coal on?
Yeah. I mean, there's a huge irony in all that. Again, you know, we could devolve into socio-political talk about what is this all about, but it just doesn't, if you're trying to solve the global CO2 problem, the way we're structuring our renewable investments are not going to do it. Because like you said, what are we doing? We're burning more coal. And, you know, and what we're doing is because of the inherent instability of the renewable system, and the fact if it is ever going to work, it's going to require massive redundancy because there's very low load factors. Remember, a nuclear power plant operates at like 96% of capacity. A wind farm at best operates in the low 30s. So, you know, even if to get 100%, you got to basically build three times the number of wind farms. And then it doesn't always work when the wind doesn't blow. So you need backup. And when you begin to incorporate all the energy into the redundancy and the backup and things like that, then all of a sudden, none of this makes any sense. You're not solving your problem. And, but I don't know what we do to get around this thinking that it is going to solve the problem, because it's going to make the problem worse. Yeah. And, you know, and that's back to nuclear power, because nuclear power, just to show you, you know, this whole energy in, energy out, the return on energy investment, what it means. Like, I know that some of the statistics will disagree with this, but we've done our work, and so we have confidence in it. Like, the energy in to an energy out of a solar photovoltaic farm, when you include, you know, making all the solar panels, installing them, all the copper, installing all the copper is needed to hook them up, all this type of thing. You're talking about putting 5 units of energy in and maybe getting 10 units of energy out.
And is this with batteries included in that too, or yes, no storage? Yes.
No, this is with batteries included.
Okay. It's just so low, right?
Yeah, a wind farm's better. So you put in 5 units of energy, you're going to get maybe 12 to 15 units of energy out the side. A natural gas plant or a coal plant, you mine the coal, or you drill for the natural gas, you produce it, you transport it, you burn it, turn it into water, into steam, you turn the turbines, you generate electricity out the side. That's one unit of energy produces 30 units of power out the other side. You could say there's no comparison. Now, do you know what it is for nuclear? You mine the uranium, you transport it, you upgrade it, you build the whole nuclear facility, and you do the same thing, you boil water. Do you know what the energy out for that is? One unit of energy to do all that, including building the plant, produces 100 units of energy out the other side. You're talking about
everyone needs to know this.
People don't understand. And nuclear power is by far the safest method of generating electricity that is, bar none. And so, how are we going to get over this? It's a solution to our problem.
Yeah.
And not only it's a solution to our problem, but we're going to generate so much excess energy that we could have another massive global growth phase, all without CO2. So I mean, but here we are. I mean, here instead of
So Lee, like, just to play devil's advocate here, I guess the one pushback is around nuclear waste.
Yeah, but I mean, in the U.S., what we do is we have you know, the Yucca Mountain nuclear storage facility has been fully permitted. It took years and years and years to do it. Obama, on the urging of Harry Reid, if I remember right, canceled the permit at the last minute, which is inexplicable. But we have a very, very safe method of collecting all the nuclear waste that is, like, literally many things is sitting behind chain link fences at nuclear facilities and things like that, and medical facilities are using nuclear, various nuclear elements in their, imaging and things like that, sitting behind chain link fence, just sitting there waiting for somebody to steal it. You collect it all, you put it, 2 miles underground in Yucca Mountain, guarded by, all super high technology. It's perfectly safe, and we don't do that. It's blocked. It was blocked by the Obama administration for inexplicable reasons. So we've solved that solution. We took it away.
So Lee, we have to talk about your, because obviously lots of great energy conversation here, electricity, the whole spectrum. We have to get to your thunder on oil and how you see that looking going forward.
Yeah, we're coming to the recognition that there's a global energy crisis in natural gas. That's being accepted. We have not gotten around to understanding that there's going to be a global oil crisis, and the global oil crisis is again going to be driven by demand that refuses to roll over because of the factors that I talked about. Same factors that were driving very strong gas consumption are driving oil consumption. Second, because of ESGs, you've probably seen the charts on global upstream capital spending still sits about 50% below where it did back in the peaks in 2012 to 2014. It has hardly budged off the bottom. And I think that one of the reasons it hasn't budged off the bottom is because these companies are under intense attack. Look what happened to Exxon. A shareholder group that owned 0.02% of the stock was able to elect 25% of the board of directors. And what happened to Royal Dutch Shell? A Dutch court said you have to adhere to the Paris Climate Accords, which means they have to reduce their CO2 output by 2030 by 40% to 50%. And so these companies can't invest in their upstream businesses anymore. Now, why is that so important? Well, if I would have told you the statistic right now, for example, we consume about 35 billion barrels of oil a year. And that's growing. Over the last 10 years, does anyone want to know the size, the total aggregate size of new oil discoveries has been on a yearly basis every year over the last 10 years? We're using 35. Yeah. We are only finding about 7 billion barrels of oil of new discoveries a year.
Yeah.
That's the lack of underinvestment that's taking place. And the funny thing is that you have strong demand, lack of investment, which is now in the numbers. Then you have the shale issue, which is a little bit different, but you have geological exhaustion of the shales.
Yeah.
And let's see, there's a final point I want to make here. But the thing is, that next year, we're going to make an all new time high global oil demand. We're probably very near an all time high right now.
Yeah.
Regardless of what the IEA numbers are saying. By the fourth quarter of 2022, we're going to reach a point in the history of global oil markets that we never, ever reached before. And that's 160 years going all the way back to Colonel Drake in 1858 in Oil City, Pennsylvania. that global oil demand is going to exceed total oil pumping capability, even with OPEC pumping 100% flat out.
Right.
Never, ever been anywhere near that position before, including the two oil crises in the 70s, 73 Arab oil embargo, and then the Iranian crisis in 79. We have never, ever been close to that fact that global oil demand never got close to global pumping capability. And the reason is demand strong. And remember, we've lost 2 to 2.5 million barrels of non-OPEC oil supply from its 2019 peak. So
at that point, we're looking at a parabolic point, right, in terms of pricing. Yeah.
Yes. And here's the other fact that's very, very important that people don't understand. In fact, some people wrote it about Bloomberg about this the other day, and I'm saying, why are you guys so late to understanding this phenomenon? Remember, when non-OPEC oil supply growth slows, OPEC gains market share and pricing power. And the fact that the IEA now has put forth policies that explicitly try to encourage the global non-OPEC oil industry to stop investing in their upstream business, that as non-OPEC oil supply growth slows, and it's going to turn negative, it's already turned negative, yeah. But it this year it might bounce up a little bit because of all the DUC completions taking place in the shales here in the U.S., but it's going to turn negative. OPEC is going to gain pricing power. The IEA admits that. They actually state that this is going to be one of the consequences of our policies. And what is the OPEC going to do with that pricing power? What are they going to do with that gaining with market share? They're going to gain pricing power.
Sure. Lee, I wanted to ask, do you have an opinion on what price OPEC thinks is a good balance of maximizing their revenue versus not losing that pricing power?
One of the great fulcrum points is what price is needed to balance the Saudi budget. And that's about $80. So you're about there right now. Mm-hmm. But the question is that the fact that they've got pricing power now, and how much pricing power do they have? The Biden administration has already gone to OPEC and said, please produce more oil. And so he has to beg them to produce more oil. And they said, well, we'll think about it. Yeah. And which is exactly what they said. They said, we'll think about it.
Yeah, so they're sophisticated enough, right? They're going to hit a price where they want to, if it's above 80, great, but they know how to measure if there's demand destruction happening probably. Yeah. So they're going to try to thread the needle on that.
Yeah, and also they may internally recognize, these podcasts and things like we do, there's a lot of people in OPEC this is going to wind up in there. To watch this, and they may realize the very fact that if we hit like 102 or 103 million barrels of oil demand in the fourth quarter of 2022, and the reason why that fourth quarter is important because global oil demand is seasonal. It's sort of between the low trough in global oil demand, which ironically happens in June, July, to the peak in November and December. There's a swing of 2 million barrels. So if we hit 102 to 103 million barrels a day in the fourth quarter of 2022, they realize that everyone pumping 100% flat out, they can't supply that, or they can barely supply it. And so the thing is it may not matter that whether they bring the oil back or not, because they may not have it, given 103 million barrels of oil demand. And that's why I think oil market's slipping into crisis, because people don't appreciate what has happened regarding demand, which is going to make all-time new highs, and the fact we've lost 2 to 2.5 million barrels of non-OPEC oil supply.
Yeah. Oh, Lee, this is a fascinating conversation, and this is, you've been bringing a ton of insight across the entire chain, from nat gas, oil, electricity, nuclear. So, Lee, maybe in terms of where you see like the optimal positioning right now. How would you view, where we sit right now? Where's the optimal point in the entire commodity complex? Obviously, owning the one thing, in the last interview, we were talking about just invest in the periodic table and some hydrocarbons and you're good. Feels like we're at that point. But obviously, there's an optimal place, to put your chips. I just want your thoughts there. And if you are open to it, maybe a name that, you think would fit the bill. Obviously, a tough place to bring on barrels, et cetera, but companies that have meaningful reserves, et cetera.
Yeah, I think on a short-term basis, obviously, we're going to be a lot of upward price pressure on both natural gas and oil in the next 6 months. So, and like I said, there's no institutional participation in these markets yet. what we're seeing is all short cover as far as what we see. So that's a good area to be. I'm a firm believer that the world is slipping into a global agricultural crisis, that we've written about this extensively. A lot of it has to do with, again, global strong grain demand, bumping up and colliding with changing weather patterns. This is completely controversial. We don't have enough time to go into it, but I believe we're entering into, ironically, into a cooling cycle. Cooling cycles are exhibit tremendously volatile and much more adverse global crop growing conditions. And we're beginning to see this. Mm-hmm. We're beginning to see this. We have very dry conditions in Brazil last year. We had a major frost in the coffee growing region in Brazil. We've got all these weather anomalies beginning to emerge. They're racked up to global warming. I think it's because, ironically, of global cooling. Another talk for another day. Sure. So agriculture, I love, you want some stocks? I love the fertilizer stocks here.
Okay.
A company like Mosaic. It's moved up a little bit, but I had a talk with an institutional investor the other day, and we were talking about the fertilizer. And I said, look at a stock like Mosaic. There's a lot of positive stuff happening there, underlying, including the fact that they're sinking a new shaft in the Esterhazy mine, and they're going to eventually stop the water incursion problems that they've had for 30 years in that mine, and costs are going to go down by $50 a ton to mine the potash. All these positive things. And the stock traded, when the stock was 32, it's now 37 or some 38, but it was 32, it traded at 7 times this year's earnings. And, when the fertilizer cycle peaked back in 2007, 2008, the last time when, potash prices and phosphate prices hit $120 a ton, $130 a ton, Mosaic traded to 30 times earnings. There's no participation in these stocks whatsoever, and we're on the verge of a global agricultural crisis. So I think that would be a good area to invest in. It's certainly not popular. Precious metals. We're in a long corrective phase. We write extensively about mm-hmm. precious metals, and if you ever want a funny story, I was profiled in Forbes magazine back in May of 2000 or 2001, I can't remember. Gold was 270, and they forced me to make a projection, and I put gold 1,900, and we almost got there. So we understand what makes bull markets, gold precious metal bull markets run. Yeah. We're in a corrective phase right now. I believe that every investor should have significant physical gold and silver in their portfolio on a long-term basis. If we repeat the 1970s, you remember that the final 2 years of that bull market, gold and silver went parabolic, and somebody tried to corner the silver market. Now, it's interesting now. We've already had a corner attempt in the silver market with the whole Robin Hood Reddit crowd back in earlier this year. They failed for a variety of reasons, but the silver market is going to try to be cornered again in this cycle.
So will silver lead gold?
I don't think so. It's so funny. We always believe that silver will lead gold, and that's a sign of a global market. Every gold bull market have all the way through the 70s, all the way through the 2000s, silver lagged. And then when silver plays the massive catch-up rally, which it always does, the gold bull market's over. But it's silver's lagging again, which is it should. Yeah. So the thing is, but I think you should have significant physical precious metal investments. And
Lee, this is fantastic. And guys,
I want to
really thank you. Like GNR Associates, fantastic. We'll drop the link in the bio. Obviously, those listening to the podcast, we'll have it wrapped up in a pod available to everyone. Lee, this has been incredible. I just want to thank everyone watching on YouTube, Twitter. If you haven't already, please give it the thumbs up because, Lee, we got to have you back.
We're going to have a lot to talk about in commodities over the next year and a half.
Yeah. And like I said, if you want a really insightful talk about renewables and in the energy restraints, the problems with renewables and why they probably won't solve our problems, he's the person to talk to. He's an expert on this stuff.
Yeah. We were going to have Adam on today. We were blessed with having Lee on. We're looking forward to having the both of you guys come back regularly. Lee, a very good friend of our partner, Chris Wood, going back and, two greats. We're very fortunate to have that, guys. Lee, thank you so much, for, for all the insight. I feel like you've given us a time warp back and just given us a lot of history that everyone, context is so important in resources. And I think just one of the big takeaways here is just this underinvestment and where we stand today and how early we are in the game.
Okay, very good. I enjoyed this immensely. And thanks for having me on. And I'd love to come back and do it again someday.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much, Lee.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We'll be back with another expert interview.